the falling leaves drift by the window.
Ah, you know, leaves turn beautiful colors in the fall, and they fall to the ground eventually. But you know why those leaves turn those beautiful colors? Can you explain it? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Bassam Shakashiri back with us, professor of chemistry at UW-Madison, is a national proponent of science and science education. Talk with him about the science behind leaf color and what effect, if any, climate change will have on our yearly fall color display. And like you to be part of the conversation, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, we'll talk more about more than leaves. We'll talk about climate change. We can talk a bit about other science education issues that may have come up. And certainly, again, answer your questions. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Call at 1-800-642-1234. And Bassam Shakashiri, welcome back.
Happy to be here with you, Larry, as always. You're right, those dazzling color changes in the fall,
not only in
Wisconsin, in the northern hemisphere, as the amount of sunlight diminishes, the temperature changes, the amount of moisture in the air also is a big factor in causing these giant factories that make chlorophyll, which is the green pigment in the leaves, begin to shut down as the amount of sunlight goes down, as the moisture, as the temperature change. And then eventually those leaves don't produce the chlorophyll, which has been masking all these colors that are already there. And we begin to see them. And you know, this year has been a good year so far. Well, today, you know, a little bit of snow overnight.
Yeah.
But on my driveway, there was a carpet of dazzling color changes on top of the white snow. So and last night I was talking to a friend in New Hampshire, and she said that near Franconia, very, very vivid color displays. And it is really fascinating to watch this natural occurrence every year. Some years it's not as good as it is, you know.
This year it's quite good.
It's very, very good.
Vivid. Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting. Some of the trees you'll see bright yellows, other trees bright reds. And you wonder sometimes, well, why are they the different colors?
Well, because they have these different sugars in them, in the leaves. They're already there, but the color is masked by the predominant chlorophyll that is produced by via photosynthesis, which is a natural process that takes carbon dioxide, combines it with water to form the variety of different sugars. But when these giant chlorophyll factories begin to shut down, we see these beautiful, beautiful colors. You know, there's some blue colors also.
Yeah.
There's also brown. To me, the brown is not as attractive. That's another thing that I think about. What is it that goes on in our brain that makes us appreciate aesthetically these natural phenomena, whether it's in the fall or some other phenomena, you know, throughout the year? This is really the joy of discovery, the joy of understanding the beautiful, complex world that we live in and how the different components interact with each other and how we as human beings are doing some things to affect those changes.
Yeah.
And that relates to
the
issues of climate change and global warming. But it is, to me, it is fascinating, especially with the advances in the neurosciences that are still in their infancy, I must say, how they help us begin to understand the sense of appreciation that we have of a variety of transformations that happen not only in front of our eyes, but also related to what we hear with our ears. The senses all work together, Larry. And it is really, really fascinating to me that advances in neuroscience are helping us figure out what goes on inside the brain. Very complex chemical transformations, all electron transfer reactions. For those people in the audience who studied chemistry in high school and college and so on, remember talking about electron transfer reactions. That's what's happening when the neurons fire or even when they misfire. But back to the natural occurrence that we're enjoying. And, you know, the snow that we had in the overnight, it'll dissipate until what, Thursday? We're getting another?
Yeah, then we get another batch. Yeah, at least in southern Wisconsin, there'll be another 6 inches or so heading our way.
Yeah, so, but these the sugars in the leaves have made up of different components, and they have different colors. How light interacts with chemicals to produce the chemical changes that we see. That's really fascinating. The science of autumn leaves is really very fascinating to me. That's why on my website I've put a learn about entry. If you go to my website, scifun.org, scifun.org, and on the left-hand side, you easily can see a place where you can click about the science of autumn leaves and what goes on and the different components that are involved. It's the attempt that I have, along with my group, to share the joy of discoveries that we do when we do scientific research and when we commit ourselves to engaging the public with the appreciation of science, in this case, the beautiful chemical transformations that produce these colors.
As you were talking, I was just thinking about my daughter, Emily, because she has a chemistry test this morning in her chemistry class, and I'm wondering if that might even come up as part of a question and a test.
Well, if it comes up, you know, she can go back to it. And yes, we have testing in schools. And a lot of people think that we should study for the test. We should study to enjoy what we learn. Testing is an incentive that we have in our school systems to help us understand what we have learned and what we should be learning. But it should not, to me, be the major driver of what goes on in the school. It's the satisfaction of the curiosity that we have. Why do these leaves change color in the fall?
Yeah.
Why don't the evergreens change color?
Yeah.
Why
do the evergreens hold on to their needles, which their leaves?
All fascinating questions and all have to do with satisfying the curiosity that we have. And we try to satisfy our curiosity. We have to be patient. We have to be vigilant. If anyone is looking for immediate gratification, that's not satisfying the curiosity. The important process of asking the question and learning how to come up with reasonable explanations for the question is what's really important, this process of engagement. Of course, the right answer is important, but it's not the most important thing. It's the appreciation of the variety of changes that we observe through the senses and how we try to enjoy the beautiful, complex world that we live in and how we try to be protective of the environment that we're in.
Terry emailed wondering if that great amount of rain we had this year or the reduced sunlight because of it causes the leaves not to be as colorful. Apparently, they aren't as colorful in her, where I'm not sure where she is. She says they usually have fabulous colors, but this year there were a lot of spots on the leaves, and they turned a little golden, then dried and fell off. That probably has to do with some disease or a pathogen of some sort.
It could be some disease of some sort, as you say, Larry, but also the amount of moisture, you know, varies with location.
Yeah.
The amount of sunlight also is a factor. How low the temperature dropped? Did we have a hard freeze? All kinds of factors affect these beautiful chemical transformations that we see and we get to enjoy. And I remember when I first moved to the United States in 1957, living in Boston, Our host took us on a tour in New England
around
this time of the year.
Whoa.
It was just fabulous. It was amazing. I just couldn't – I was speechless. Can you imagine me being speechless, Larry?
Hard to imagine.
It's just a dazzling display of vivid coloration. And we ask questions. What is color? What causes our brain to receive signals that tell us what the colors are? How does the brain then make sense out of the information that we get? This whole topic of perception.
Yeah.
How the mind makes sense of the information that we receive. And to me, what's really more important than all of this is the action that we end up taking as a result of the knowledge that we acquire. And I'm hopeful all the time, as you've heard me before, saying that we should take responsible action for what we are doing to the environment so that we continue to enjoy the great advances in science that help transform society.
Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, professor of chemistry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He comes by every so often to talk about a whole variety of things. We zeroed in here a bit on leaves and fall color, which is always beautiful and mesmerizing to me often. But we'll take other science-related, education-related questions as well. If you have those, you can join in, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And some callers online. Chris in Adams, I think, is with us next. Chris, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I can answer the question about why we are not attracted to green or brown leaves. And this is an adaptive function of our having lived in the forest for many, many years while we were getting into civilization. I'm a painter, an oil painter mostly, and I have an acclaimed eye for color. The reason is that the green of the forest is, we have learned to exclude it from our vision because reds and yellows and blues are food, they are danger, they are other things. Brown is fecal matter. You avoid those kinds of things. It's just like built into our psyche.
Hmm. Interesting.
Thank you, Chris. Larry, one of the big joys I have being on your show here is hearing from people in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate Chris's comments about her view of and her knowledge of why the brown is not as attractive to us. I'm always wanting to hear from people in the listening audience. So more, please, more, please. But I want to go back to Terry's question just a couple mm-hmm. of minutes ago. Sometimes we don't see the red and the yellow because we don't have that tree that has, you know, that type of tree that we have makes a difference, whether it's mm-hmm. an oak tree or a maple, a sugar maple or some other. And so the coloration is really a product of the type of tree that we have in addition to changes in moisture, temperature, and amount of sunlight. So maybe Terry was referring to trees in her neighborhood that always have the same color change. I don't know. Should have asked her before.
Just to go along with that, Nancy emailed that while driving west one morning, between Eau Claire and the Twin Cities, there was very little color, mostly green, the trees were. The next morning, the very next morning, driving back east toward Eau Claire, the colors were spectacular. They literally changed kind of overnight. They did have a cold night. Can leaves actually turn beautiful colors in 24 hours. Seemed like magic.
These chemical transformations are very sensitive to temperature, and yes, that can happen. It did happen. You observed it.
Mm-hmm.
I observed it in my backyard, driving around Madison. There's certain streets in Madison where the color change was very vivid and changed within a couple of days of driving in the same street. There was one road in Madison that mostly has these brown-colored trees, which, you know, I noticed.
Yeah.
I personally don't find them as attractive. But yes, Nancy, the factors that I mentioned, especially temperature, amount of sunlight, and also there's another point here that I would like to share. It's our own individual ability to pay attention to those changes and to heighten our awareness so that we make these observations, enjoy them, and try to make sense out of them. Thank you, Nancy, for your comment.
Greg in New Berlin has something for us. Hi, Greg.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
My question is, I think, a biochemical or nutritional chemistry question, where we're told or advised to eat high-fiber foods such as kale, cabbage, greens, etc. Do those foods have the same effect physiologically if we consume them in a powdered form?
So the fiber, so not they would not be then fibrous, I guess.
That's my response to what the question is. Yes, it's important for us to enjoy and benefit from nutritious food. And the form of the food is important. How we eat it is important. Sometimes you have to make up, use the blender to mix all kinds of different things. That works too. But I would say that mixing the colorful items that you mentioned it is a very important nutritious thing that we should follow. But I should also say, because I am reminded every time I visit with the medical the people that I visit with, that, yes, we should have green color items that we eat, but we should also remember protein. And so I would take advantage of your question to mention the importance of having a balanced diet. And also don't forget a little bit of fat, not too much fat.
There you go, Greg. Dave and Osseo, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Dave.
Hi, Dave.
How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
First of all, I want to thank Vasav for the joy and enthusiasm he always brings to your program, Larry. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Question I have, and I hope I'm not putting you on the spot. I know you're not a botanist. But what about the tamarack tree? Why does that always change color? And I consider that, and maybe I'm considering it wrong, a member of the evergreen family.
You know, Dave, I don't mind being put on the spot because when I don't know the answer to the question that comes up, I try to find out and try to share it by posting the information on my website. So I don't know the specific answer to your specific question. I'm not a botanist. I'm not into plant pathology. But that's a very interesting observation. This is the nature of the curiosity that we have as human beings, and it's very important to ask those questions, even if the person you're asking doesn't have the answer right away. So I promise you to find out, and I'll post it on my website, siphon.org, under the place where I list my appearance on the Larry Beeler Show. I promise you to do that.
And thanks very much for calling, Dave. Bill in Beaver Dam emailed that we're on trees here today. The past couple of years, his ginkgo tree leaves haven't turned yellow and have fallen off gradually instead of the more common yellow and falling off in one day. He's still waiting for the ginkgo leaves to fall this year. What might be causing this change?
My guess is that it's the again, the change in temperature. And the weakness of the leaf being attached to the tree. That's my guess. I want everyone to appreciate that the three factors that I mentioned, the three main factors that I mentioned, sun, amount of sunlight, temperature, and moisture, those are the general factors. There are specific properties of the trees, of the leaves, of the pigments that are in the leaves that are there because of the different sugars that are in there. And so each one has its own characteristic behavior. And it isn't one size that fits all for all the explanations here, but the three main factors are the dominant one, but they're additional specific factors.
Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Sarah Hopeful, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. We're talking science here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of science today with Bassam Shakashiri, professor of chemistry at the UW-Madison. Always great to have him stop by. We've been talking about trees and leaves turning color, but there are other questions out there that you may have, and I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. So this, yeah, this is your 50th year of teaching, by the way.
It is.
How's it going this year?
It's going great. I am very fortunate to be in my 50th year as a faculty member in the chemistry department at UW-Madison. Larry, I've been to every institution in the UW system in the past 50 years. Maybe I'll make another round. Who knows? I am very fortunate. It's a privilege to be a tenured faculty member at UW-Madison. Our state is a place that is hospitable for people who enjoy doing scientific research and other types of research, mm-hmm. too. Our university is a world-class university. And it not because I say so, but because it is so well recognized. We get students and scholars from every corner of the state and from every part of the nation, as well as from around the world, that come to UW-Madison and benefit from the outstanding research and teaching and public service activities that we engage in. And that's why I feel very strongly that I read in the news just last week that the Department of Natural Resources is going to increase the number of scientists on its staff. There was a cut a while back ago in the staff size, but it's going to go back. And we need scientists doing research to help advance knowledge, but also to serve society. DNR and other state agencies are committed to public service and to high-quality work. And so I'm very pleased that our government is moving in that, our state government is moving in that direction. I wish I could say I'm as pleased that the federal government is moving in that same direction. Instead, what we see are cuts in EPA regulations that are meant to protect the environment. We see changes in emission regulations. I am a person who's an advocate of good regulations for the benefit of society, but I'd like to see science be serving society. I'd like to see our elected officials everywhere, locally, at the state level, at the federal level, in the Congress, in the executive branch of the government, in the judicial branch, benefit from the wonderful advances that science has made and how to have science serve society. So this is my plea to everyone in the listening audience to support your candidates in the upcoming election and also to influence on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, the interactions that you and I and others have with each other about the connection between science and society. Science does not provide answers to all the questions that we have, but science provides great opportunities to satisfy our curiosities, but to also help advance the human condition. And it takes collective effort on the part of individuals and communities to assure the proper role of science and the proper support for scientific research in society.
Tom in central Wisconsin has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
How you doing?
Good.
I really appreciate this show, and my question is a little bit long, but I'll try to shorten it up. Basically, the trials for studies for things like ALS or multiple sclerosis are out there, and I looked them up for ALS after being diagnosed and watching two of my family members die of ALS about these trials and studies, and I found 136 of them, and 95% of them are in other countries that are working with stem cell research. They found the genome that causes my ALS, but it's almost impossible in this country to get stem cell research. I'm wondering how close we are to getting that at home.
Well, thank you, Tom, for your observation and for your comment. And I express sympathy to you and others in your family. Yes, we need to be open in our pursuit of knowledge, and we need to be careful how we use the knowledge that we come up with. It's true that in other countries there is more openness about stem cell research, but our own campus here with Jamie Thompson, you know, 20 years ago, who pioneered the work on stem cell research, we're still doing it. This is why I say it's important for everyone in the community to participate in respectful conversations about the role of science in society and about the importance of having good regulations that assure us of the proper use of the knowledge, the scientific knowledge that's being developed not only in the United States but around the world. You know, science has no geographic boundaries. But within geographic boundaries, we have to develop good attitudes to dealing with the issues that that face us. The National Institutes of Health and the U.S. Public Health Service are outstanding agencies in terms of the scientists that are in them that address these matters scientifically, getting the information to the public and getting it put into responsible, meaningful practice, that requires the participation of all of us in this process. That's what democracy is all about, Tom.
Thank you, Tom, for calling. Appreciate it. You know, there was an analysis from a nonprofit economic research group pointing out that a particulate matter air pollution in the U.S. rose about 5.5%, if I'm not mistaken, from 2016 to 2018. What should we take away? It seems like a very large change.
A big change, and particulate matter in the environment has an effect on a variety of health issues. It's important that we understand what this set of data tells us. It's also important to ask questions about the validity of the information. I'm not questioning the validity. I'm saying that everyone should participate in the process of validating the information so that we make our own decisions individually and collectively at what to do about such matters. Particulate matter, you know, is emitted from coal plants. Mm-hmm. It's emitted from smoking. Mm-hmm. It's emitted from natural volcano activities. Just understanding the complexity of the world that we live in and what we as human beings, the inhabitants of the planet, are doing to our own environment is very important. So the concern that I have is that these data about particulate matter are a telltale that we should be paying attention to, because it can relate to global warming issues and the amount of different transformations of particulate matter in the environment, in the atmosphere.
You can join in, too, with your questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. you look at the polls out there, it seems that most people now agree that our climate is changing. Some believe human activity is contributing to the change, and most people do, and some, but some do not. Can you talk about where the science comes into play on this?
I am pleased to see increased awareness and some more understanding about global warming. This is happening because of conversations that are taking place, because of political action that is also taking place. I think it's important for everyone to really become aware. I'm not saying you become an expert. Become aware of the factors that we follow in our daily life that affect climate change. Because climate change is going to continue to have an effect on all of us. Those who know the science and know about the consequences of it, and those who deny it. In recent years, the number of deniers, at least the way they express themselves, has changed. You know, Larry, there are economic factors that are in play here. There are social factors. There are environmental factors, the quality of water that we have, the quality of what goes on in the soil where we live. All of these factors are contributing to the understanding that our over-reliance on fossil fuels as a source of energy is something that we should do something about right away. We're not going to stop driving cars. We're not going to stop flying, but we should diminish our reliance on fossil fuels as a source of energy, so that we end up, and I want to use now an expression that may not sit well with everybody, but we have to have a carbon neutral way of life. We still want to enjoy everything that we have in our society, but we have to take responsibility for the continued emission of carbon dioxide into the environment, which is the causing a great deal of a change in our climate, because the carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. There are other greenhouse gases,
yeah,
Larry, but carbon dioxide is the one that comes from the burning of fossil fuels. That's important. So each one of us can take individual responsibility to learn more about the knowledge, to increase our knowledge of climate change. We can commit to take responsible action to help mitigate global warming. We can engage with family members and community friends in conversations about global warming. We can buy less stuff, can reduce, reuse, recycle. We can change light bulbs. Have you changed light bulbs, Larry?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Change them all.
All of them. I haven't done all of them yet.
I'm working on it.
I'm up at 75% there. Use a programmed thermostat. We're coming up on winter time here. By the way, the winter is going to be a little warmer than before, but that doesn't affect the temperature setting. A temperature setting is something that we do. This is something we can control. And I can also switch to a hybrid motor vehicle or an electric vehicle. And there are changes in that direction that are helpful. Are they happening fast enough for me? Not quite, but they're happening, and I'm okay about that.
Dave in Northeast Iowa, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I'm calling from Northeast Iowa, and I'm very concerned about the environment, and my biggest concern is corn ethanol and how the government subsidizes it. And there's about 20% of Iowa that's now corn for corn ethanol, and it could be prairie or forest or wetland, which kind of rejuvenate the soil for generations to come. And instead, we're kind of using it up as fast as we can for a product that's forced on us and paid for by the government.
One of the things I could mention, and Bassam, you may want to chime in on it, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, or GLBRC, has been doing a lot of work, and actually those folks view corn ethanol as a, all right, it's almost like a first generation of alternative fuels, and there are a lot of other materials out there that the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center is working on that would hopefully take away the use of corn in ethanol eventually.
That's a very good point, Larry, and I agree with what you said. And Dave brings up a topic here that, again, takes me back to our understanding the economic consequences of what we do in our society. And just think in a very analogous way, think about the tobacco farmers in North Carolina and other areas, and how that their livelihood and their well-being has to be taken into very strong consideration in terms of any governmental action, any societal action that we undertake. So the same thing applies to the use of alcohol, ethanol specifically, in different parts of Iowa and other parts, you know, in Illinois as well. So it's important to understand not only the science of what's going on, but the ramifications that affect us economically and socially, and make for each one of us and all of us collectively to make intelligent choices that are in keeping with our own well-being and also protecting our environment.
Yeah, Dave, you might want to take a look at the, if you typed in GLBRC, Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, there's a lot of information on their website about the kinds of research. A lot of it involves prairies and switchgrasses and forests. So it would certainly be worth a look for you. But Sam, we've got Once Upon a Christmas Cherry in the Land of Shaka Sherry, the 50th year.
It's coming up, December 1st.
Yes.
And we have received requests for so many tickets. They're almost all gone. We have approximately a couple of hundred tickets left that can be requested. So the sooner you send in your request, the sooner we can respond to you. We're expecting close to 2,000 people to attend this event on December 1st. It's going to be videotaped by Wisconsin Public Television and aired later on. But if you'd like to come in person, please go to my website, scifun.org, scifun.org. Right in the middle of the page, you'll see the number 50 flashing. Click there, and then you can click a couple of more times and fill out the ticket request form. They're free tickets. We use them to control the size of the crowd. We don't want someone to show up and not have a seat. So please send in your request as soon as possible. As I say, the tickets are almost all gone.
But Sam, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much. We'll look forward to your next visit. Thanks.
Thank you, Larry.
But Sam Shaka Sherry, professor of chemistry at UW-Madison. Always great to have him come by, and I expect he's going to be back, and we will do this again with him. You know, last night's snow is a good reminder. It's time to put away the spring and summer outdoor power equipment like the lawnmowers and the leaf blowers maybe, and get out the snow throwers, the generators, and the other small engine equipment. And we're going to be talking about that, getting your equipment ready for winter. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.